It's just about time for us to get started this evening. Thanks for being here. I'm looking forward to our class as we officially start our class on the book of Judges. There are printouts on the back table later this evening if you don't already have one. Also, one's been emailed out with this schedule on it. And a schedule is helpful for me just to hold myself accountable, keep a good pace with the class, make sure we make it through all 21 chapters by the end of January. Not that I'm looking forward to that date at all at this point, but if you will pick up one of those schedules, please, or just consult it. The electronic copy that was sent out for the purpose of reading the verses before class each week, just so that by the time we come to class, we won't be spending in class time reading the majority of the verses, so you'll be familiar with more or less what we're going to be talking about. Be much better for our study than coming in cold, not really understanding or remembering what it is we're going to be discussing. For the first few minutes before we dive into the first chapter, which we'll cover tonight along with the first five verses, I want to do just a brief review of our introduction that we had last Sunday morning, Sunday before last, and just remind those who are here or tell those who may not have been here that the book of Judges covers about a 300-year period after the time when the Israelites had been delivered from Egyptian bondage, but before the time where they had the kings. And it's a time of upheaval and sin and disgrace and unholiness. Lots of terrible things happened during this time, and it's a very bleak chapter in Israel's history with some high notes, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, a week before last. And they went from, as you may recall, a time of relative unity under Moses' leadership and even Joshua's leadership, which we'll cover at the introduction to the book this evening, to a time of assimilating with the heathen nations that they were meant to dispel, along with being influenced by the nations that still surrounded them. And that's an important distinction. So there were always going to be nations around the children of Israel that were going to be bad influences on them, Moab, Egypt, for example. But then there were the Canaanite nations that they were always meant to get rid of. And so that they didn't do that and started assimilating and intermarrying with those nations sets up the terrible events in the book of Judges that we'll come to read. And then finally, by the time we get to the end of Judges, it's essentially anarchy and civil war. And so really goes from bad to worse. As we studied in Joshua a couple of months ago, these were all of the allocations for the land for the Israelites in Canaan. And as we'll talk about tonight, according to chapter 1, this is the actual land that they were able to conquer at the end of chapter 1. You can see that a lot, particularly the plains of the land, were left unconquered. The book is broken up into three chapters, so we're going to spend the first 2 weeks on the first two chapters, which are the introductory chapters to Judges. The second and most common one that you think of, which is chapters 3 through 16, which are the stories of the various judges, the various hero stories. And then finally, the last five chapters describe that really sad period when there's just anarchy, like I said before, and civil war. And the cycle that we'll read about and talk about next week in our class, according to chapter 2, really doesn't do justice to the entire progression of the book of Judges, because we start off pretty good at the beginning, but then it spirals down into a very terrible end that sets us up for wanting a solution to the great problems that the children of Israel had. All right, so for this evening, we're going to dive into chapter 1 in just a bit. First, I just want to remind us that we're in this first part of the book of Judges, these first two chapters. And in this first section this evening, we'll talk about the first 21 verses here in Judges chapter 1. The tough thing about chapter 1 in Judges is that there's a lot of overlap with what's already been talked about in Joshua in terms of all the places that we read about where the various tribes went and attempted to conquer. And these initial battles start really in the southern region of Israel and work their way north. And not only do they start in the south and work their way north, but they start with successes and progressively move towards failures, as you probably noticed toward the end of chapter 1, where the author is listing all the territories, all the cities and places that the various tribes were unable to conquer. The challenging thing, though, about these verses is that all of this is couched under chapter 1 and verse 1, where it says, after the death of Joshua, whereas much of this, having been covered in Joshua, seems like it took place before Joshua's death, which occurred, just if you flip the page back to Joshua chapter 24, is recorded there at the end of Joshua. So I don't have it nailed down 100% when all of these events took place. It's possible some of them are mentioned in chapter 1 as a flashback. It's also possible that when they were mentioned in Joshua as having happened, that it's a figure of speech called prolepsis, which means speaking of something that hasn't yet happened as if it's already happened. And that actually occurs in chapter 1. And let me find the verse. Verse 2, where God says, Judah shall go up, behold, I have given the land into his hand. And so God is speaking of it as a done deal. And so that may be the sense in which some of this is meant in chapter 1. So I'm not exactly sure as far as timeline goes when all of these battles took place. The overall message, though, is clear, is that Israel did not do what they should have done and completely conquer the land of Canaan as they had been promised. It's also important to remind you all that the narrative in Judges is not necessarily chronological, because in chapter 1 and verse 1 it says, after the death of Joshua, and as we'll talk about at the beginning of next week's class, in chapter 2 we read about Joshua's death in verse 8. And so just keep that in mind as we go through the book, that this is not necessarily chronological. It's more showing the arc and the story of what's happening with the children of Israel at this time. You notice, though, in the first part of chapter 1, that they inquired of God what their next steps were to be. So even though their leader Joshua is now dead, they took the initiative and asked of God, okay, who should take the lead in conquering the land? And God says it should be Judah. Judah then asks for Simeon's help, and they together start to conquer these lands. We'll mention in just a moment. But this starts off on a good note, where they should have, where Joshua, their leader, is dead, but they're still inquiring of God what they should be doing next steps. And that's basically the only time in the entire book we're going to read about that happening, where the Israelites are asking God, what should we be doing in this situation? At this point, though, you'll remember that we're still in the period of not Joshua's life, but Joshua's contemporaries who outlived him. And that's an important distinction to make, because we know from chapter 2 that in verse 10 it says, and all that generation, referring to Joshua's contemporaries, also were gathered to their fathers, and then this other generation, the next one, arose who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done. So in the first part of this chapter, immediately after Joshua's death, we could safely say that they still had this good group of wise, honorable people who were advising them in these various situations. But it is clear that, unlike in Numbers and Deuteronomy, where Moses was very intent on having a successor, making sure that there was a clear follow-up to him, that's not the case with Joshua. And whether that was God's plan originally or should have been Joshua's initiative to appoint a successor like him, I don't know. But we do know that it didn't work out well for the Israelites with this breakdown in leadership over time. And so what does God instruct the tribe of Judah to do? Well, he instructs them to continue their conquest, and they ask for Simeon to join them. And on this first conquest, they defeat the town of, or city of, Bezek, and capture the leader there called Adonai Bezek, who is trying to flee. And with the first, you know, kind of graphic description of God's justice, cut off his big thumb and toe, which he had done, according to his own admission, to 70 other kings before him. And so he was kind of served his just deserts in that situation. So their leader is conquered. The Israelites, you'll have to remember, are God's agents of judgment. So they're not just arbitrarily killing people. These are, again, the Canaanites that they were meant to dispel. So they're working here with the tribe of Simeon to defeat this town or city of Bezek, and we'll move on in just a moment to the rest. You'll notice that in these first couple of chapters, there's one tribe that features very prominently, and that's Judah. In fact, Judah and Benjamin are kind of the two most popular tribes, or most commonly spoken of tribes, in the book of Judges. And so what significant Bible characters came out of the tribe of Judah? Wyatt? Caleb was from the tribe of Judah, yeah. He was technically a Kenizzite, which was a foreign clan that had been grafted in. But yeah, and we'll read more about Caleb in just a moment. Who else a few hundred years after this? King David? That's right. Ah, very good. Two of the exact answers I was looking for. So King David was from the tribe of Judah, and then Jesus ultimately comes from the tribe of Judah, which had been prophesied about that the Messiah would come from the tribe of Judah. And so they're featured very prominently and shown as being very successful in this endeavor. Benjamin, on the other hand, was the home to which, or the tribe of which king? I'll give you a hint. It was the first one. Saul. Yeah, so there's that comparison that you may start to notice threads of throughout the narrative here is Judah's dominance and then Benjamin's as well, just as the ancestors of kings David and Saul. So I know I've talked a lot so far. What questions or comments do y'all have on these first seven verses here in Judges of them initiating the conquest here in Canaan? Jer?
Text, but on that picture you had, that's the town you said that they take? And it, I thought you were saying 10,000?
Yes.
It doesn't look like an area today in a way that would support that many, but it must have been something else if there were 10,000 there at that time.
Yeah, and what we read about a lot in Judges are coalitions of armies,
and so it's like this Adonai Bezek working with the Perizzites, I think it is, and they're kind of gathering up against the Israelites. So they're amassing a force in that area. Yeah, good comment. All right, next they go on to Jerusalem. So originally Jerusalem was built up here on this eastern hill because it was closest to Gihon Spring, but obviously this is more or less what it looks like today. So they conquer Jerusalem. Again, these are the men of Judah. Then they go down to the lowland in Canaan, the Negev, and then against Hebron, and defeat three leaders there, Shishai, Ahiman, and Talmai. So those are the three guys that they defeat there. And these events, again, are also recorded back in Joshua 14 and 15. And again, maybe told here as a flashback. I'm not exactly sure on the timeline there, but this is Jerusalem and then Hebron, which is another city that features prominently in the Old Testament narrative, having been where Abraham settled and built an altar back in Genesis chapter 13. And verse 18. We've talked about, you know, the history of Jerusalem before, and it's tough for us now to envision a time when Jerusalem was not part wholly of Israel, but really it wasn't conquered until David's time, all the way in 2 Samuel chapter 5. And so it goes back and forth between who's in charge of Jerusalem over these many centuries. Next, they're going to fight against the inhabitants of Debir, which was formerly called Kiriath Sefer, which means city of the book. And on this occasion, Caleb, as in Joshua and Caleb, says, whoever conquers this city can have my daughter, Aksa, in marriage. And who was it that successfully conquered Debir? And got to marry Caleb's daughter. Othniel, yeah, thanks. So Othniel, we'll talk about again 2 weeks from tonight because he's the first judge that we read about in chapter 3. So Othniel marries Caleb's daughter, and there's an interesting family relationship, which I haven't exactly pinned down, because it said in verse 13, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. So whether Caleb's younger brother refers to Othniel or to Kenaz tells us that Othniel was marrying they may refer to Othniel or Kenaz, in which case Othniel was Caleb's nephew. So it was either, so there's a close family relationship here that is not commonly seen today. Okay, so, and then what happens after that is that Aksa, the daughter, is given land and then asks for springs to accompany that land, which would have been very important for settling in that area and agricultural purposes, and Caleb gives that to her. And so, again, this is a man who for decades has battled on behalf of God and his purposes and is continuing to fight strongly on his behalf. But I don't think we read about Caleb's death, but eventually he dies, being part of Joshua's generation, and then that next generation arises that does not honor God with their actions, and that's part of the tragedy of this story. Again, I don't want us to get too bogged down with all these places and names that are talked about here, and so we'll just briefly go through these next few verses, verses 16 through 21 now. Next, they conquer a place called Zephath. They're aided by Jethro's descendants, who's not called Jethro in this passage. In verse 16, he's called the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law. So he's called Jethro back in Exodus. And in this context, he's just referred to as Moses' father-in-law. They help the Israelites in this part of the conquest. And there, they had settled in the city of Palms, which is another reference to Jericho. So anytime you read in the book of Judges, city of Palms, it's referring to Jericho. Then they capture three Philistine-controlled cities. This is, again, all in the south. So that's Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. At this point, they're able to capture them and subdue them. But even later in the narrative of Judges, these three cities revert back to Philistine control, which, again, is a sad commentary on the Israelites' unwillingness to completely eradicate the Canaanites who had lived in the land. And what's noted here, even with Judah's endeavor, is that they were able to conquer the hill country, but not able to conquer the plains. And so that's where the Canaanites still were able to keep their strongholds, or in these plains. And one particular tool that they used made them have an advantage against the Israelites. Do you remember what that was, what they had that made them better at battle, Ed? Iron chariots, that's right. You can see that iron chariots would be really advantageous here, but in the hill country, which looks like that, iron chariots aren't going to do much good. And so it makes sense then why the children of Israel were able to inhabit those hill country areas, but still had such trouble in the lowlands and the valleys. So we're starting to see, even at the middle part of chapter 1, an incomplete conquest on the behalf of the Israelites, which lays the groundwork for their downward spiral into unfaithfulness. All right, we're going to pick up in verse 22 in just a second, but what questions or comments do y'all have so far? Anything else? Yes, sir.
/ question, and I've always wondered this. Why didn't they? Okay, because they had iron chariots, but God promised them the victory. Why did they not complete the task? Because they really say iron chariots is not a reason, it's an excuse. Obviously, they feared that technology, but why didn't they?
God had certainly subdued forces much greater than 900 iron chariots before this. Why didn't they? You're exactly right. The answer, I don't think, is given explicitly in the text. What we're going to come to read is that these tribes that failed to completely eradicate the land kept the peoples, the indigenous peoples, for lack of a better word, as forced labor. And so they may have seen that as a better alternative to putting them all to death, that, oh, it's better for us to have these slaves than for us to kill them. Or, as God had warned them about, they had already gotten into the promised land, gotten comfortable with the houses and vineyards and everything that was already there ready for them to live in. They didn't have to do really any work for it, and they just got comfortable and complacent. But
in spite of the iron chariots, they could have. Otherwise, in the beginning of chapter 2 that we'll get to in a minute, why was he angry with them? And I think in there is something for us to take to heart, right? That we've been given a task to do. He's told us to do things, maybe flee from sin, and maybe, you know, assembling on the regular schedule with the rest of the brethren in the local place, maybe all these other things. Maybe a question we need to watch out for sometimes is, why haven't we? Why didn't we?
Yeah, that's a great takeaway from
there. We don't do the things that we need to do. We don't become as strong or as mighty in the faith as we need to. And I think back to one of the pictures you showed a while ago, in that plain, even today, there's a lot of farming, and those are areas even around here where we have the lush valleys and things where you grow, and there's a lot of wealth to be made there, although they had the vineyards and things in the mountains in the hill country, but they also didn't have access to those ports they should have. Israel could have been much, much greater blessed had they had finished, and they didn't go there.
Yeah, they certainly achieved their zenith of prosperity during Solomon's reign. You're right. They could have achieved that much sooner had they followed. Right. Yeah. But even that doesn't last forever. Right. Yeah. Sad. Anything else before we move along? All right. Just know the rest of the judges is not like this. It's not just lists of cities and tribes. So we're going to make it through here, get the big picture, and then move into the stories that really are page turners. All right. Moving on now to the end of chapter 1. This is where gears really shift to the incomplete conquests and this laying the groundwork for their apostasy. So Bethel is the next city that's conquered here. The exact location of Bethel is unknown. It could be there, or there, or there, or somewhere else. And so they're aided by a resident of the city who is approached by spies, and the spies ask him for the entrance to the city. I don't think they mean, you know, where's the main gate into Bethel? I think they're meaning, where is the secret entrance? And so something like this would have been common in cities like this, so that during times of battle or when they were being laid siege upon, that they could still get out and maybe get water or supplies or other things. And so I think what they're asking here is for information on where a secret entrance like this is to the city. And so he tells them, that aids them in their defeat, and then he moves off with his family somewhere else in the land of the Hittites, build a city there and call it Luz. And so now the end of the chapter 1, is detailing, whereas we've already talked about conquests overall in the southern portion of Israel in the land of Canaan, now it's going to talk about the failures. And so all these tribes, it's going to discuss the cities that they were unable to conquer, unwilling to conquer. As has already been mentioned, God had promised them the victory, but they weren't willing to follow through. So these verses at the end, verses 27 through 36, describe these incomplete conquests. And as I mentioned before, many of these peoples who lived in these cities become slaves. And there's precedent for this, not that it's an approved precedent, but do you remember back when we talked in Joshua chapter 9, how the people of Gibeon deceived the Israelites, made them think that they were actually from a far-off country, but really they were just like 5 miles down the road. And Israel, without consulting God, entered into a treaty with them and said, you know, we're not going to harm you, and we'll come to your aid in battle if you need it. So there's precedent for this happening, but again, that was not part of God's plan. I'll just quickly reference something back in Deuteronomy chapter 20. But in Deuteronomy chapter 20, God makes a distinction between two areas of land. The first area of land is described as those areas very far off from the Israelites. So in my mind, it's these surrounding nations, Moab, Ammon, etc., not the land of Canaan. And to those surrounding regions, the Israelites would offer peace to those peoples, and if accepted, then they would become forced labor. If they rejected the peace offering, God says the males were to be put to death, and then the women and children were to be spared. But, to be clear, for the people of Canaan, all of these folks that they were meant to conquer, there was to be no peace offer. In all those situations, for the Canaanites, so the Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, no one was to be spared. In verse 16 of Deuteronomy 20, it says, save nothing, save alive, nothing that breathes. Clearly, then, that's not what they did. And the author of Judges, the Holy Spirit, through the author, is saying, because Israel failed to obey, they were setting themselves up for failure, certain failure, which we'll see time and again throughout the narrative in Judges, where these people and their idols and their worship practices became a thorn in the side of the nation. So in summary, this first chapter describes successful conquests overall in the south, but failures in the north. And that's not only the layout for this first chapter, but actually is going to model what we talk about in chapters 3 through 16, where we'll move gradually from endeavors in the south, successful more or less, to progressively failures in the north by chapter 16. So just notice that progression as we move through. All right, so that's all I have to say on chapter 1, but I'll pause here and see what questions or comments you all have before we move along. Yes, ma'am.
I noticed that several different things happened to these cities that were not conquered. Some were set to tribute, some they just lived among, and others they had forced labor. So it looks like there was a differentiation between cities am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, you're right. They did do different things with the peoples of those cities.
But again, if I'm understanding what God had commanded in Deuteronomy chapter 20 correctly, for all of those cities, it should have been complete and utter eradication. So it seems like in this first chapter, with them handling things differently, it was them doing what was right in their own eyes, which again is a theme of Judges. What else? Yes, sir.
It just occurred to me, I preached on Nebuchadnezzar last Sunday, and he was God's instrument to punish Israel later. And he might have been a better instrument than Israel was. They're supposed to be an instrument to punish Canaan right now, and they're not doing it. Nebuchadnezzar probably did his job better for God, ironically.
Yeah, being as proud and egotistical as he was.
Yeah. It's sad. Chapter 2 is going to delve more into the attitude problem behind the Israelites during this time, and the word that comes up and resounds more than the other is stubborn, that they were stubborn. They were unwilling to listen to their leaders, and as we get into chapter 2, that'll be a take-home lesson for us, is what failure we will experience when we're stubborn and unwilling to yield our will to God's. Did you have your hand up, Janet? All right. Anything else before we go on? Alrighty, then we'll talk about the first five verses of chapter 2. So we're now introduced, or reintroduced, to the angel of the Lord, an angelic messenger from God. And it said that he went from Gilgal to Bochim. And so you'll recall back in Joshua, they cross the Jordan River, and their first encampment was in Gilgal, which may have been here. And their first city that they conquered was Jericho, or the City of Palms. So again, Jericho is referred to as the City of Palms in Judges instead of calling it Jericho. So Gilgal may have been here, and we're told that the angel of the Lord goes from Gilgal to Bochim. To my knowledge, this city of Bochim is only mentioned here in verse 1 and then again in verse 5. And some think that it's also another name given to the city of Bethel, which is another city in this region at this time, because Bochim seems to be a temporary name given to it. Does your Bible have a footnote as to what that city name means? Weepers, that's right. And so seems like that's a temporary name given to another city based on what ends up happening here in verse 5 of chapter 2. So the angel of the Lord goes from one place to another, and in this speech, in these few verses, he reminds the Israelites of God's deliverance from Egyptian bondage and how God had provided a homeland for them. But by this time, he states clearly that they hadn't obeyed God because they had made covenants with the peoples of the land and they had not broken down their altars. This is a reproduction of an altar that they might have encountered in the land of Canaan. And these are some other altars that the Israelites might have found in the land of Canaan. By the way, if the Israelites were to build an altar, what would make the design of this one wrong in God's eyes? That's kind of a weird question. So would God approve of an altar like this? And if not, why not? Wyatt? Okay, yeah. That's right. So very specifically, back in Exodus chapter 20, God said, when you build an altar, do not build it out of hewn stones. Just building it out of hewn stones would make it unholy. So yes, not only did they not break down these altars in the land of Canaan, but they also constructed ones like this in violation of God's directive. So they made covenants with the people, as we'll notice at the beginning of chapter 3. They intermarried with them. As we'll notice in chapter 2, they started serving their gods like Baal. This is one representation of him. This is another representation of him. You know, as we look at that, we have some time, because we get out of this class at 40, right? Okay. As you look at that, you think, what is all the fuss about? Like, how could people be so wrapped up in this? But then I thought, you know what I should put up there? I should put a picture of a cell phone up here and imagine, what if we show the Israelites a picture of a cell phone, you know, what is that, 3,000 years ago? They think, what's all the fuss about? Like, why would people get so intertwined in that? So it goes without saying that there's a lot of societal and historical context that we don't understand with this idolatry, but We certainly have idols that we're tempted to serve today. They just look different than what the Israelites struggled with then. And also, as we mentioned in our class last week, what were the depths that Israel sank to in the worship and service to these idols? Well, yeah, that's right. We learned that from Psalm 106. In fact, God had warned them of that in Deuteronomy. He said, don't even, in paraphrase, don't even mess around with their idols. Don't learn what they do or how they worship them, because they sacrifice their own children to these idols. And then we learn from Psalm 106, a historical psalm depicting part of this period, that's exactly what the Israelites ended up doing themselves, all in service to idols like this, thinking that they were appeasing Baal or Ashtoreth or Ashtoreth, all these gods of the land of Canaan. So to be clear, God had made it abundantly evident to them that he had established his covenant with them, the children of Israel, that they were to completely eradicate these Canaanites, but that if they didn't, there would be certain consequences. And so that's what the angel of the Lord is making clear here. So that by the time chapter 2 rolls around, which is some years after them beginning to inhabit the land of Canaan, they had not fully obeyed God. And he says, because you've done that, now you're going to suffer the consequence, which, according to verse 3, he says here, so now I say I will not drive them out before you, but they shall become thorns in your sides, and their God shall be a snare to you. The NET translates that a little bit differently. So see if you can pick up, I'm reading from the ESV normally, but see if you pick up on the nuance here. Judges chapter 2 and verse 3, at that time I also warned you, if you disobey, I will not drive out the Canaanites before you. They will ensnare you and their gods will lure you away. So instead of being a new pronouncement of judgment here, the angel of the Lord may be saying, God already said, this is what's going to happen when you disobey. And in fact, that's exactly what he had said in Joshua chapter 23, 12 and 13. Sadly, you just think of the history of the people of Israel and how much hope and promise they had coming up out of Egyptian bondage and being told of the promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Then they had a period of the 40 years of wilderness wandering due to their unfaithfulness. But can you imagine at the end of that, the hope and dreams that they had of finally having a land to rest in? And then we read just a few short years later, this is happening where they weren't able to fully conquer the land, and now they're going to have such trouble for the next 300 years. So if you were in this crowd, as if I were in this crowd, upon hearing this pronouncement of judgment, the people weep. They mourn and they sacrifice to the Lord. But as we'll come to see, this change of heart does not lead to a lasting change, which would have changed the trajectory of the narrative in Judges for the better. But again, it's not going to get better from here. It's only going to get worse. All right, that brings us to the end of our material for class tonight. What comments or questions do y'all have before? Yes, sir.
Thing to consider here in this first few verses of chapter 2 about the angel of the Lord. Quite often, if not close to all the time in the Old Testament, where that phrase is used, it's talking about Jesus in his pre-incarnate work before he came to earth thousands of years later. We know for sure that that's talking about Jesus in some context. Here, I'm not quite sure, but it seems likely that he's talking about Jesus.
Possibly. So, and the messenger,
heavenly messenger, it reminded me of back in Joshua chapter 5, when at the end of that chapter, Joshua encounters the commander of the army of the Lord. And there, because I thought there was a parallel, but I'm not sure, there in Joshua chapter 5, Joshua offers worship. And that's accepted. And so in that case, I think there's a clear difference, because if this was just an angelic messenger, we wouldn't have been able to accept worship. But yeah. All right, very good. Anything else? Oh, we're making great time. We're going to get through 21 chapters, no problem.
So this little passage here makes it very apparent to me, at least, the difference between being sorry and actually repenting. Because they were definitely sorry when the angel told them what they had done wrong, and they went so far as sacrificing, but they didn't actually change anything. They didn't go out and clean up all of these messes that they had left, which is probably what they should have done in that case, or at least done that as they continued to fight, but they didn't do any of that. They just were sorry for a day, made some sacrifices, and forgot about it the next day.
That's right. And that can kind of be seen as the first episode in the cycle that's described in chapter 2, where the people are oppressed, they're crying out to God in repentance, he saves them, then they have a period of rest, but then revert back into their old patterns of behavior. All right, so what's our takeaway for this evening? Application for us is that if we fail to completely eradicate sin from our lives, it will also result in a disastrous downward spiral, just like it did for Israel on the level of a nation, but for us individually, it can also, this downward spiral into unfaithfulness. I'm reminded of what Jesus said in Matthew 18:8, if your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than with two hands or two feet to be thrown into the eternal fire. So takeaway for me is, you know, I can't sit back and judge the people of Israel too harshly, because the very same pattern that they exhibit over and over again in Judges is one that is evident, has been evident in my life. And so we have to ask ourselves, what's lingering in my life? We ask this individually, what's lingering in my life that's either causing this downward spiral or could cause such a downward spiral? And then let's be motivated to do something about it, knowing, you know, God's given us these examples of the disastrous consequences if we fail to completely eradicate sin. So that's my takeaway for this evening. And just as a friendly reminder, for next week, we're going to plan to cover the rest of chapter 2, which will more or less talk about that cycle of sin and deliverance. And then we'll get into chapter 3, which has some great stuff about the first judge, Othniel, and then Ehud, if that's how you say his name. And again, I just don't know, and I'm not criticizing the Bible as literature, but I just don't know outside of Judges where there are stories that you just read and are as captivating as what we find in Judges. So be sure to read about Ehud and his victory over Eglon and also over the people of Moab, and we'll plan to talk about that next week. That's all I have. Does anybody have any concluding comments before we stop class tonight? All right, thanks so much.